Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, J. Tony Serra. Tony Serra is a San Francisco-based criminal defense attorney, wrote Walking the Circle, Prison Chronicles, while serving in Lompoc Federal Prison Camp in 2006 for tax evasion. As part of his article, Letter from Lompoc, published in California Lawyer magazine. Tony Serra's books, Walking the Circle, and the Green, Yellow, and Purple Years in the Life of a Radical Lawyer are in the lobby, and I believe that Tony would probably stay and autograph, purchase copies. So, without further ado, let me introduce our distinguished speaker, J. Tony Serra.
Pretend that I am uttering a primal scream. I'd like to do it. And I feel it. The scream would be because as I sit here and stand here and feel myself present, that old thing about a fish out of water. I'm a fish out of water, gasping, you know, for breath and therefore screaming for oxygen. You think that is a metaphor that describes my presence amongst you all, but it's not. You see, my little microcosm, my fishbowl, is jury trial. Very tunnel vision, very limited, very encased, very self-contained. And I've lost myself in that. For now, over 50 years, going from trial to trial. So as we're here, I am in about the sixth week of an alleged assassination case where a number of Serenos are charged with the death of their alleged, you know, war adversaries, Norteños, brutal, harsh, bloody, shot, knifed, full of, you know, despair, pain, anger, court crowded with law officers, most of whom have automatic weapons and bulletproof vests. They expect an armed evasion. We've been taken from one courthouse, the normal one, given our own courthouse, so that we can be encased in essence by law enforcement. So that's what I've been breathing. That's what I've been thinking. That's my mind, you know, is in that zone. So when I'm here, so it's like it starts with trepidation, anxiety, indifference, detachment, spontaneity in terms of involvement, all of the myriad emotions, that unstable one, or at least me, or maybe I come, you know, potentially unstable to begin with. I never, you know, lose the opportunity to propagate a position, be it political or legal, polemic, recreational. So this would be both political and legal. Didn't want you to miss that persona. I'm going to start now, and I'm going to try to do it in a disciplined fashion. I just want to premise, we all have really different basic inventory instinct. Ultimately, when there's strong obsession to fulfill instinct, then we are, you know, configuration of those instinctual objectives. So it's variable. So I'm peculiar, I'm aberrated. I'm what they call a color eater. I've devoured color all my life. I regard color as some kind of direct, conduit to first enlightenment, second maybe a form of spirituality. So where others may have immersed themselves in a variety of, sought-after perceptions to travel, to fish, et cetera, I've always sought out color, peculiarity, but other than myself, most of my family tree are involved in something, and we'll call it aesthetic level. Sculpture and painting and art and all of that. And I went off on the wrong side of the brain in terms of my family tree. I got stuck somehow in the logic, rational, causation, legalese. Got caught in that world. But somewhere down there, thankfully, there's this impetus and this desire and this obsession for color. So I wrote a few poems. Remember always, a bad poet makes a good lawyer. So I'm up here because I've been a good lawyer, not because I've written any good poetry. It's all bad. But I did write in anticipation, and when I was so kindly introduced, Jim Bustani, yay! A friend. A colleague, an ideological peer, I hope. I forgot where I was. Any rate, what was misstated in the introduction and has been on occasion is that I have not been convicted of any kind of tax evasion. That's a cheater. That's someone who underestimates his income or whatever. I am a tax protester, so my convictions are misdemeanors, no moral turpitude because they are part of a lifetime anti-tax ideology, platform, activism, political perspective, et cetera, et cetera. And the State Bar has been very good to me, so they've never yanked my license. I go into prison camp, I'm able to help the inmates with their writs, I'm able to help the inmates, with their civil matters, visit upon subject matters that maybe I only touched in law school, bankruptcy and contracts and corporations and creditors' remedies and, dissolutions. I don't know, went on and on, fabulous for me, and it's like locking a doctor in a hospital who likes to practice. Any rate, I see time is still going. Let me start with some of the poems that I wrote, anticipating going in with emphasis on the color, because the book is chromatic metaphor. And I'll talk not about that, but I'll read some of what illustrates that. So this is before prison. I gorge myself on color because colorless is fated now. To the sea for red sunset, to the rolling grassed hills to eat greenness. Yellow roses, big ones, melting. Yellow sun blinding me, purple flowers so purple. I fear the overwhelm of that color. and blackness too, the blackness of outdoor and indoor dead night. I revel, I sate, I dance, I splurge, I eat, I sleep, I drown in color, die in bright light, glowing, piercing my life, 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 everlasting. That's one. Two, I intoxicate on sound. I intoxicate on sound. Awaiting cacophony, I fetish on sound. The dot of it, the roar of it. Human voices, song, echoes of insects, birds, wee voices of dew, dropping to ocean thunder, sound of dogs, tail wagging, and hear hawks and crows, sounds intermingled. My ears grieve with bells of churches and cable cars, screaming parrots, children's mirth. I see the sounds. I mix them with the colors. I need smells badly, third poem. Soon I'll be in odor doldrums. So now snort flowers. Now drink perfume. Now scent live air. Put my head into the spring grasses. Inhale delirium. Salt spray and a eucalyptus leaf. Mint and lemon plants, I fan the air towards me. My eyes and ears and nostrils are wide open. Next week, I thrive on memory. Do the odds and ends, another poem. Before jumping headfirst into the precipice, I worry to complete minutia, phone calls, letters to my children, last-minute details for my clients, trying desperately to pay the bills, tax men still barking, farewell to friends, clean the bathtub, shine my shoes, who will water my plants? My mind paces back and forth across the office floor. Next poem, do I stuff food into my face in readiness for hibernation? I know prison steams with prenatal burgeoning life de novo. New thoughts, new plans, the overview, the underview, the vital cries for rebirth. It's a space between the sower. It is a space before the sower sows. No reaping, no harvest in jail, but ideas of reaping and harvest. I know I will be buoyed by the force of such prison imagination, but I promise I shall not nourish my mind by memory. However, the dinners of goodbye inundate me and destroy my well-marked intentions. Oysters and halibut, wines and cannabis, prickly salad, the barbecue, the expensive restaurant, the table talk over food and drink, the farewell eulogies, even tears on napkins and averted eyes, my belly too full, my mind too soggy, my life too many good friends, my psyche prays for Spartan, my head defecates the morsels. Next one, I will walk naked into prison. The book says bring nothing, only money for phone calls and commissary, and eyeglasses if needed, All the rest will be taken and sent back. I strip the outer bark, it's easy. Books will be sent. Writing material will be discovered. Legalese will transmute to nudity. I proudly walk naked into the cell, but covertly I carry my mind and resolve. I carry ego and vanity. I carry beauty and logic. I carry meditation and poetry. I carry so many burdens, my nakedness goes unperceived. Well, next one, which is really the last one. Prison is not punishment. I see the glint of pain in my loved one's eyes, like, husband, dad, will it hurt? Will it diminish? Will it weaken? Will he supplicate? Has moral jeopardy imposed a sanction? With purring words and gentle smiles, I scream, no, never, not me. I don't pay taxes. I am a free mind. I am not a captive of capital or government. My head is high, my chest puffing. I have not yet eaten my peanut principle of taxless society. I am not disgraced. I am not martyred. I carry my little banner of excelsior into prison. Well, now it's bad poetry. I'm a collection, you know, of platitudes when it comes to poetry. I read it, and then, you know, the nature of a lawyer is that we're plagiaristic, that we're taught to be plagiaristic. They wean out of us any creativity, any innovation. You know, stare decisis, that means you follow precedent. Mr. Sarah, what did they say on the subject in 1890, you know? You want to say, under your breath, like, well, you know, I won't talk under my breath, it's being recorded. So here, I'm going to be mindful of the clock, so I'm going to be this book. Green, obviously, is youth. Yellow is maturity. Purple is, there we call it, the declining years. So what I just did, and I did it on a lark. It was just fun. And I call it somewhere, I think, that was reproduced, that sparks or, you know, colors from psychedelic remnants of the 60s. So you're in there, and you are deprived in many levels, and you're embellished in others. You know, when the door closes, the window opens, as they say. So I had in mind two books, which I finished, and then this one I had extra time, and I used my time very diligently. I wrote it just, I don't know, spontaneously, without kind of thinking, just for fun. So it's not literal. I said that somewhere. It's not, you know, a detailed account. But what I do is I go into color metaphor, then I go into a number of cases in every color, and I'm only going to do a little bit at the beginning of each area and one or two little parts of a case. I'll talk a little about the case, and I'm going to jump to yellow. It'll be fast just because of time constraints, although, my friends, it might be boring. The green years. I was born emerald green. I guess that I am one in a million in this respect. My mother told me that I glowed green iridescence in the dark as a baby and seemed to project a green halo. She said I was like a green jewel, sparkling green rainbows from my crib. I was beautiful, but eerie and mysterious to them. My parents tried to keep my greenness secret. They thought it would disappear as I grew, that it was just an infant stage. But I remain green for 30 years. I still sometimes shimmer with iridescence. My green hood enlarged as my childhood proceeded. A Kelly green moss covered my body. My hair was grass-like, my eyes like green hummingbird feathers. At times, my arms and legs extended from my body as vines and tendrils. When I laughed, small green flowers floated out of my mouth. I would lie stomach down in the unkept grasses of our backyard for hours, staring sideways at the growing foliage with awe of its green strength. Green grass, green leaves, green snails, and green bugs were my early fascination. When the wintergreen grasses first appeared thin and juicy, I would pluck handfuls and stuff it into my mouth. Eating young grass shoots was my favorite food. Then I go into one of my early cases, which Huey Newton, recall, was the chairman of the Black Panther parties locally. But beyond that, he was a national spokesperson for what we'll call a black movement, which was included a lot of whites and Hispanics, but also included other groups. And I was just starting, you know, and I was sleeping. I might be in here in the Panther houses because thought it was going to be raided after one of the Panthers was killed back east by law enforcement. And then you could have rifles, so it was all sandbags and rifles, and so-called white lawyer would come in and they'd strip you to see if you had any recording device. Then you'd sleep in front of the door, so when the police came, you could be a witness or a spokesperson, a mediator or a victim. That's how I met Huey, and he's my life, you know, you're shaped by charismatic models of human beings. He certainly was one. He was a brilliant human being. And, you know, we all appreciate maybe in his latter stages, he unfortunately became a coke addict. But before that, and that was a long, meaningful political time. I'm young, you know, I'm idealistic, I'm just out of law school, I want to, you know, represent the far left, and Black Panthers were so fabulous. And so it's part of my early memory. Anyway, this is the guy. I offered my first green bud of and by the way, was the alleged shooting of a prostitute. The only witness that ID'd him turned out to be in jail at the time. So it was a phony case. And we won handily. I offered my first green bud of politics to the Black Panthers. It was the mid-70s. The Panther movement was burgeoning across the country. I volunteered to sleep at their party headquarters in Oakland and San Francisco. We expected a police attack. I, as a lawyer, would be the potential mediator or an objective witness or even a victim. I slept in a sleeping bag near the front door. We were armed and sandbagged for protection. No police assault ever materialized, but I became trusted. I met Huey Newton when he returned from Cuba. The Panthers saw that I radiated greenness. It was unsaid, but acknowledged that I was a shamrock green clover in their midst. Huey Newton, the servant to his people, the party chairman, the greatest charismatic human being that I have ever touched, cast his holy water upon me and incanted my fructifying growth. I was young and green, growing straight upward, tall, developing branches and leaves. My roots were spreading, absorbing. My broccoli brain was expanding. Under the horticultural expertise of Huey Newton, green buds appeared and burst out, firm and healthy throughout my limbs. The budding flowers of social justice, racial equality, and resistance to unfair police practice adorned my body. I chanted with the Black Panthers. I marched with them. I imbibed their words, heralded their deeds, fought their causes in Oakland, Berkeley, and Martinez courts. My nurture
was their successes. I was stalwart like a green ear of corn. My first big case was Huey Newton's murder trial. It was alleged he had killed a street prostitute. The prosecution was sham and politically motivated. At least a dozen different and mutually exclusive descriptions of the real assailant had been given. The major witness who had precipitated the arrest and prosecution of this national hero of black people, who said she definitely eye-witnessed him kill the victim, turned out to have been in jail on the date of the occurrence. And then skipping a lot, this is after the win. Green had dominated the trial. It had infiltrated darkness. We had sent green radiance into the black hole of the judge's bench. We had ensnared the prosecution with vines. I had stood in court on mowed and unmowed grass. I had sermoned on green worms and birds. Green fish had swum out of my mouth. I glowed, fluttered, swirled about them. All colors of green, green prismatic rainbows, shades of greenness engulfed the courtroom, infused the jury. Grass grew in the halls of justice. My thoughts, my words, my ideas gushed greenly from my throat. It was a rush, an unstoppable force, a core of life thrust, an energy of the green sea, the green earth, the green planet. Huey Newton's trial for me was my first experience in harnessing the green force that underlies all life on earth. So now jumping quick, I think, to yellow. We're doing good. Lawyers talk too much. Everyone knows that. Probably stems from a bygone era where you're paid by the word. So we avoid simplicity, directness. People think that this is deceitful on occasion. The yellow years. And mind you, there's a whole bunch of cases, and I just gave you the flavor, a little color, a little case, a little mix. As imperceptible as spring transmutes to summer, I flowed from green to yellow. Much later, in the fullness of my golden years, it was obvious to me that I was adorned in gilded raiment and tread beneath showers of sun-flung gold. But the early transition phase, being unanticipated, took me unaware. Lying in verdant clover, cleansing in morning mist, nestled in plant and grass, I glimpsed a change in my bodily hues. The green moss fuzz covering my skin was turning yellowish. My grass-green hair flecked now with gold dust sparkle. My eyes emitted fire yellow. I felt my aura glowing, golden rays of energy. In several months, my greenhood evolved into yellowness. I stood a golden eagle with golden crown, ready for flight. I had become a mature semantic warrior with armature of gold, begilded sword, and voice that was a rush of yellow feathered arrows. Green parrots and green hummingbirds that had once surrounded me became yellow canaries and golden finches. Green bamboo became yellow cornfields. Marijuana plants turned to sunflowers. Green flies to yellow jacket bees. Green apples to yellow plums. Butter and egg yolks nourished me in lieu of vegetable and salad. I gathered to my bosom the poppy, marigold, and goldenrod, and walk no longer amidst the green succulents and virid flora. My jewels became of gold rather than emerald. So the case that I'm reading in the mature years, and this is a time where I was actually going all over the country trying cases, it's the Bear Lincoln case. And Bear Lincoln is a Native American who resided in Round Valley, as you know, up in Mendocino County, somewhat close to Ukiah. And there was a great upset that had occurred in the reservation. Without going into a lot of detail, law enforcement flooded in. Without going into much detail, they severely abused every Indian man, woman, child there, and a whole string and host of constitutional violations occurred, for which there was a civil rights suit that I wasn't part of. But Bear and his friend were leaving. They didn't want to be gone, be there. In the hills there, you carry guns. Everyone carries guns. So they had, each of them had a gun. They were kind of walking on a trail overhead, and the Acorn, his companion, was shot by ambush, and turned out to be two officers in a patrol car in the bushes, and they just killed him for no reason. He would ultimately tell the court. Now, of course, what they said is that he had fired first and they returned fire, but thank God the FBI came in and closed the scene. So when Acorn had fallen, he fell over his rifle, it had, and they were honest, it had never been fired. So my guy turned and ran, and the officer had an automatic weapon. He was with another officer, and so the guy was shooting, you know, almost randomly down the path. And in retrospect, what occurred, he went off the side of the path, and the gun went up, and unfortunately, it went into the skull of his companion. But the case against my client was that my client had shot the officer because he had a gun, and they did find a shell down the road. But the truth is, he jumped off and ran like hell. So when it came to trial, and we proved with expert witnesses and direct testimony by our client and any other corroborating type evidence, it was shown that the metal residue, you know, antimony, and a few others was consistent with the bullet of the officer, and not consistent with the bullet that, you know, fit my client's rifle that he had discarded anyway. So it was an acquittal. It was a fantastic case. This is part of it, you know, just kind of honing in on one of the focuses of the case. And we were allowing medicine men to smoke our client, which means, you know, abalone shell and bark, and go into the jail holding cell right next to court, and you come out and you're just steaming. And okay, the medicine man approached the counsel table after the jury was seated. He unfurled the doe skin wrapping on the tabletop. Bits of bark, herb, stone, feather, and shell were displayed. As a Christian can hold a Bible, as a Muslim can hold a Quran, so can an Indian under our First Amendment have his holy objects close at hand, at trial, in his spirit, as his spiritual resource, as his manifestation of holiness and personal integrity. We perform the smoking ritual, the unfolding of the holy objects, every single morning of trial, all in full view of the jury. We cast a spell upon them. How could we lose? Our legal team was extraordinary. Most of our paralegals were Native Americans. I physically resemble Indian features. Omar, a young office lawyer in our office who assisted me along with others, also appears Indian. All of us sat behind and beside Bear Lincoln in court. We enveloped them in our shield of Indian mysticism. Most of our witnesses were Native American. The percipient eyewitnesses, the expert witnesses who testified on historical, political, social, and economic factors of Indian existence in Northern California. I recall the qualification dialogue of the experts. It started almost like a chant. State your name. Long Eyes, Campfire. State your education. Harvard, PhD. State your expertise. History of Native Americans genocide. State your tribe, Apache.
proud, solemn, straightforward in word and spirit were our Indian witnesses. The courtroom in Ukiah was encircled by Indians. The courthouse in Ukiah was encircled by Indians. The courtroom was encircled by Indians. The jurors were encircled by Indians. A circle of truth, a circle of trust, an honest, forthright embrace. And I think I pick up later just for a little bit.
He was acquitted, and you know, it was a death penalty case, so it was rejoiceful and established once again a small avenue of trust between the white man and the Indian when Indian confronts white man's law. They always have this kind of expression that justice, white man's justice, means just us, i.e. the whites. So this is one, but we, you know, as indicated, we used everyone that we could who was Native American. So this is a comment on the case. The meaning, the value, the worth of the case in retrospect was manifold. It showed that Indian unity produces Indian success. It showed that in the court system, Indians must share in the defense of Indians. It showed that the jury justice system could work for the Native American. It showed that gold begets gold. I betook myself to a high meadow above Ukiah, above the vineyards, above the lakes, where hawks circle and the deer still graze. The erect dry grasses were bright yellow. The midday sun bulged low above me. I lay down in the voluptuous stretching, yearning stalks of yellow hay-like growth. I became radiated, a glowing sulfurous ember of vibrating life. I entered and merged with the oneness of the purity of gold. I transmuted, I transcended. I became the disembodied bliss of summer fruition. We had won. We had prevailed. We had cast our yellow seeds of light into a dark domain. My yellowness was content. And last, the purple years. I'm post-purple, but I was purple when I wrote it. But I'm still fucking working, you know, like 12, 14 hours a day. My yellowhood flamed orange, then to red hot coals, providing a blistering heat to my existence. I emoted fire. I burned fierce redness. I entered a short stage of life devoted to my self-consummation. I had traveled from green innocence to yellow maturity, to a fiery conflagration at my summit. I became my own idol. I was a red Buddha. I was an arrowhead of fire. I was a scorch and a branding iron. I churned like a bubbling ravine of molten lava. I was arrogant, aloof, imperious. I was a burning splinter in the psyche of the establishment. Going on in the same area, but skipping. Then came the sky purple of sundown. Between the redness of the apex and the dark blue of death lies the purple realm of existence. Odors of lilac and lavender, purple wine and purple figs, the jewelry of amethyst and the ornate velvet bishop's robe all adorned my presence, the fresh winds of a magenta sunset, the cooling rains from a purplish sky bathed me, sustained me as I entered my final stage of legal foray. As I became the purpleness of the bishop, of the cardinal in the domain of law and courtroom, as I became the wetness of burgundy rain, I realized, we all realized, that I was headed for the darkness.
but for a decade I would splendor in my stature, the deep, rich, scarlet, crimson symbol of authority, even though an authority image of the antithesis. So the case I selected in this, out of this bunch, but there's a bunch of cases, is the Rick Tavish case. So, as you know, in Las Vegas, the royalty of the microcosm, and the top are the casino owners, and casino owners get what they want. So the decedent in this case was very wealthy, second or third generation, I think second casino owner, so prominent, powerful, and influential. He had a mistress, and she had an affair with my client, and the older man was found dead. So it was a murder case, and they first attributed it to heroin because he was actually been kicked out of the casino management because of his heroin addiction. And it was ultimately found he'd bought the night before he died 12 bags of Mexican heroin, which is a low level, but it can get, you know, street ready about 0.5% to say 1%, but it can get up to 5 or 6%. But he was used to doing it. And then they did find in the bathroom some of the balloons in which it had come. But they were reluctant to say that it was an overdose of heroin. And it was obviously an overdose of heroin. It turned out he had more heroin in his system than that would kill an elephant. So they got a pathologist out of New York, a television type hero, and he came up with a Birkin theory. Oh, they sat on his chest, you know, hand, put their hand over his mouth, so it's completely spotless. And there was like a button imprint on his chest. And that shows you they were Birking him. That's a concept of killing someone without anything showing physiologically. So we got our experts, and, you know, it wasn't a button, and it wasn't the wrong place, and we debunked the pathologist for the government, so it was an acquittal. He was acquitted of the murder, but he did and his girlfriend steal $6 million in silver, so he was convicted of that. But it was an exciting case and gained national prominence, so I just picked this one to talk a little bit about it, because it's a more recent, large, you know, publicity-type case. I saw the case in simplistic juvenile metaphors. Rick Tavish, my client, strong, handsome, intelligent, the Black Knight rescuing the fair damsel from the smoking dragon villain, both of them ensnared by the dragon's allies and held captive in their towers, an eye of violet robe, the purpled wizard would extricate them, I, master of Mauve, to give eulogy for the passing of the demons. The defense overwhelmed the prosecution. An aged voyeur millionaire funded the stripper's case. We had ample money to bring in the country's leading pathologists. They wholly debunked the Wizard of Oz, the state's humbug pathologist. The Birking theory of death was resoundingly ridiculed. Binion's blood showed enough heroin to have killed an elephant. He had obviously died of a drug overdose. The jury took little time to find the pair not guilty of murder. The crude passion play performed in court had the stereotype platitude happy ending. National TV re-echoed the melodrama. Talking heads shook their jowls, and the journalists rewrote their books. I went to the mountains outside of Las Vegas above the high desert. I went alone. They say the mountain gleams with red rock, ancient iron strata, streaking angles of blood in the uplifted terrain. But I saw only purple. I swooned mountain high at the purple ridge, sawing its way into the purplescent skies. I figuratively cut my wrists, allowing thick purple life fluid to ooze from my spirit and enter into the merger of air and earth. I was in oneness with the purple grandeur. I fell supplicant to the vital live energy of purpleness.
And then, right at the end, kind of a summing up, I'm talking about, oh, my mind paces like a tiger in a cage, awaiting freedom to resume the struggle, blah, blah, blah. Then I recognize tax boycott now is quixotic. The mentality of the U.S. citizenry is, for the most part, blind obedience to the fiats of the empowered class. No protest. No demonstrations, no resistance, no uproar or rage to any demands put to it by government or industry. Where are the Thomas Paines, the Thoreaus, and the Emersons? Why are we a nation of huddled sheep? The U.S. government is hated and feared by the greater world population, but the U.S. populace remains mute and subservient, stripped of fundamental democracy, shorn of its basic constitutional rights, wage slaves to the capitalists. We surrendered our freedoms to an encroaching totalitarian state without a whimper. I see at prison camp the glazed-eyed stare of the mandatory sentence martyrs. I embrace the pathos of the discarded victims of the draconian judicial penal system. I absorb the cruelty and the unfairness of the long incarcerations of youth, of the impoverished, of the uneducated, of the aged. I touch the legions of prisoners walking the prison circles for decades of their life. No probation, no parole, no touch of a woman. Their emotions withered and waned, an outcast society of living dead. We have more prisoners, more prisons, and more forfeited lives to the judicial system than any other country in the history of the world. These are my brothers. I will not forsake them. My purple warriorhood will continue after release.
So that's a sampling of the books, ladies and gentlemen.
Let me add... I'm going to mispronounce her name, but I love her poetry. Maya Angelou? Yes. And remember her title, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings. So, you know, I try to absorb that. I read the book. I still don't get it. But let me give you an example of what occurs utilizing that metaphor. In prison, very few of the cage birds, we're talking steel cage, do sing. 5% might sing. Maybe not seeing it, you know, as an aberration in their manifest destiny. You know, it's my destiny to spend the rest of life in prison, and you know, the same air that exists outside, inside, the same laws of gravity, the same sciences. We see the sky, you know, we feel the fragrance of a breeze, and so what is there left to do but sing? But let me tell you, the majority fall into two categories that I've seen, and it's the cage bird running against, flapping its wings, and frantically flapping its wings, and hitting the side of the cage, falling to rise again, flapping, flapping. Barrage, you know, of, I don't know, pain, till they finally flutter down. It's terribly sad. There's no life for them. They do everything they can to resist it. And what bloodies, I'm not talking body, sometimes body, but it's mine. It's psychic, you know, torture. So that inmate probably is 50% of inmates, and that's not singing. Next, this might be the saddest, it's those birds that just fall to the bottom quickly. Oh, and they cower, and they, you know, they shake, and they die. They don't fly, and they don't fight, and they don't sing. That's the ones that become depressed. We call it, oh, psychiatric depression. Send the shrink in, depression, give them a few pills. But there's a terrible pathos, you know, to see human suffering. And there's been a lot of unfair law, you know, promulgated to put these people away. You've heard of mandatory sentencing. You've heard of three strikes. In this fashion, the legislature controls the judiciary. Judges don't have discretion when there's mandatory sentencing. The balance of powers is thrown, you know, asunder. There's no checks and balances. So something that all of us have to keep our eye on. End of story. You got a few minutes. I'm told there's questions on occasion.
Okay. You give a station break. We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to J. Tony Serra with The Green, Yellow, and Purple Years. Tony, I know there are questions because I have two in my hand. So let's start with, and if anyone else has questions that you've written, just pass them to the aisle and we'll get them up here. May I?
Of course.
All right. Please tell us, or tell us more, about the green force that you felt in Huey Newton's trial.
I'm mindful from the preamble to the event here that this is a seminar, I don't know, a presentation for people 55 and older. So I'm looking around, I don't see that. I see a pretty good mix. But there is a perspective that we have to be very watchful of as we mature into, let us call it, the purple years. And it's romanticizing, idealizing our youth. Oh, the food was better then. The prices were cheaper. People were friendlier. You know, we really used to get together, man, and hang out. The music was incomparable. You know, wasn't the 60s fantastic? Wasn't the early 70s something that in my lifetime was, you know, the pearl of life? You see, that's the way a mind works, the way a rational mind works, but ain't necessarily true. And I don't know, I force myself to say in the present. I don't want to hear about nostalgia. Well, this is like going back, I'm in jail and I'm doing that, but there is, you know, the psychedelic or the color aspect, which is a little bit of present consciousness. It's not necessarily romanticizing the past. So let's get to the question then with all of that in mind. You see, what was my feeling? My feeling
think of your own youth, romanticize and idealize your own youth. And, you know, maybe not everyone had a youth that was fruitful and energetic and achievement-oriented, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, your glowing moment, think of your glowing moment. You won the race, you got the A+, whatever is meaningful in your scheme of values, and it was fulfilled, you know. So think of that moment, the rush of it. The innocence, you know, added to the experience of youth, the maybe social approbation, maybe the reinforcement of your peer group, maybe your loved one's smile. You know, think of the heart and the fluid and the force of the they call Elan Vital, the life force that's present in all youth, plant life, fish life, animal life, human life. And that's how it felt. You can put any metaphor you want. You can use green, you could use anything you want, but it is an unstoppable force. It is, you know, an energy, manifestation, emanation, vibration, force field. It envelops everything. It's sometimes enough to keep you glowing for the rest of your life. So, you know, the metaphors of green, when they reinforce, you know, the power of growth and the power of youth and the strength, you know, of mind at your apex time period in life, which is youth, not old. That's the way it felt, baby. That's the way it felt. You've ever been in a court. See, everyone's got their own, you know, microcosm, their own way, but mine's in court. So you're giving a closing argument. Yeah, man, the court's just fucking packed. There's people out in the hall. They're around the whole building. Give it to him, Tony. Yeah, man, that's the way it goes, man. Yeah. You know, like it was like an evangelistic church gathering. We couldn't lose the case. Well, how does that affect greenness? You sprout. Think of a flower in the sun, you know. Think of that. It's just pushing up. And then it's what a... Does everyone send the glory of a flower bursting from, you know, a green stem, opening up to the sun for the first time? You know, you ask, or the question is, how did it feel? That's the way it feels. Put yourself in, you know, the metaphor of a bursting flower, the first burst, the first, you know, sun kiss that you receive, the first fullness of life, the first, you know, self-supporting, self-sustaining, you know, experience. All right, next question.
All right. I think I have a yes or no question here.
In every test I ever wrote in college, when Jess and I go yes and no and tell them why.
All right. Well, this is as close as we're going to get to yes and no. Tony, you and your brother Richard are my heroes. Will you take your inspiration on the road and nurture the millennial generation?
Well, that has, again, depths of potential understanding. One is Richard and I have been mutually exclusive for 30 years. I regard him as always, even though I'm a year and a half older chronologically, he's always been like the most severe federal judge that I've appeared before. Yeah. Highly judgmental, but at any rate, at one point we were close. So that's part of the question. The second part, I've been on the road, man. My curriculum vitae shows that I've practiced, I don't know, now probably over 50 different jurisdictions, and that I've spoken probably in about 30 different jurisdictions. So the answer is an overwhelming yes, of course. I like to go into different environments just because that's the way I'm an empiricist. You gain a form of enlightenment by just going. So, yes.
How good. All right, now we're going to combine two questions here. They're both good. The first is, in a few words, what would you say you stand for? And the follow-on is, what is the most effective way for people to make a difference today?
Okay, those are not necessarily connected.
All right.
This is my one. A person's view of himself is highly myopic. You can't see your fucking self, you know? I don't even look in the mirror anymore. let alone look at myself psychiatrically. That's why we have professionals to do that. But on a good day, I would say, on a good day, I'm a pantheon. On a good day, I am the symbol of the antithesis. Well, what does that mean? Oh, Mr. Sir, are you using Marxian, you know, formula? Yes, I have to say, but I think he got it elsewhere. What? There's a thesis, and that's called the establishment. That's the main themes of society. That's the collective, morality of a society. Call that the thesis. The thesis of necessity begets the antithesis. The one who says, no, man, that ain't right. Eating all the fish, you know? You're taking all the children or whatever it is. That's the antithesis. So in the marketplace of free ideas, the antithesis is the most important part of the evolution of humans. One, two, democracy. You got to have a voice that speaks out on unpopular causes. That's what fertilizes the whole system. So as the formula goes under Marxian principles, the ultimate union of thesis and antithesis occurs. That's when a reform movement, Black Panther Party, did get more jobs and more education and more food, you know, into the impoverished sectors. It did. So the it's a compromise always, and sometimes you can battle 100 years and not compromise, but that's the theory is ultimately the antithesis. Oh, how would I call it? Fertilizes the thesis, and a new phenomenon, social, political, economic phenomenon, emerges, and that's called the synthesis. And the synthesis is the combining of the antithesis, which I am always, and the thesis. The synthesis then, after a number of years, becomes the new thesis, which begets the intent. It's an evolutionary process. When you're optimistic, you say that the objective is enlightenment. You know, more illumination each generation. We, in this country, were abridging First Amendment principles. And, you know, I can go into 10 reasons why legally it's allowed. But without a free press, you're not allowed to amplify the antithesis. Sometimes the antithesis is treason itself. Words alone, you know, can be a crime. So where they suppress, let's pretend Russia suppresses, let's say Egypt's now suppressing, et cetera, it's normally an earmark of totalitarianism. There's only one going to be one side. We don't want to hear about marketplace idea. We don't want to hear protest. We don't want to hear demonstration. We don't need no antithesis, Mr. Sarah. You know, that's going to be a stagnated culture. And normally, the stagnated cultures are the ones that oppress and exploit. So it's serious stuff, this First Amendment, and serious stuff for people in all levels in society, so-called walks of life. You know, once a week, consider the antithesis of whatever your premise is. Consider it, confront it, analyze it. Hear what other people have to say. You know, maybe it will change you a bit. But don't step it out, man. Don't step it out. Okay. All right. One more last.
Okay, we have time for one more. Will you stay and answer a few more after we go off the program?
If it's desired, but people are going to go to lunch. But yes, of course.
Right. Good. Well, this has to do with your current action. With so much evidence against Shrimp Boy, how can you defend someone
who
like
said
him?
That? Obviously, hasn't read he or she hasn't read the discovery.
Well, the follow-on is the real question. Have you ever defended anyone you thought was guilty?
Okay, let me answer. Because one, whoever wrote it, you're not privy to discovery. You're not privy to discovery because we are gagged. They won't allow us to tell what the real investigation, consisted of. And suffice to say, we'll be bringing a motion in December for dismissal predicated on governmental misconduct, outrageous government behavior. Ain't going to be granted, but we will then raise the fist a little bit. But half of it or two-thirds going to be filed under seal because they won't let it. And we have that up at the Ninth Circuit at the appellate level. Because it's not right. The government can release stuff, which they have, which has, damaged the reputation of our client, and we can't give the other side. Under a penalty, we could be put in jail or disbarred or suspended. So they've silenced us, and we're just praying that the appellate court, the Ninth Circuit, issues what they call writ of mandate so that we can at least have reciprocal, privileges. So... I don't know. I went off on that. There isn't a lot of evidence against my client. And have I ever defended him who you thought was guilty? You read too many novels. The issue is not many times, who done it? Shit, I've had probably... I do mostly murder. I've done it 50 years. I've done more murder, more drug cases than any human being should do. I'm going to just guesstimate, but 5% of murders are whodunits. Well, who did it? Did the wife put the poison in? They're not cases like that. So it's a barroom fight, and one guy, comes at a guy with a hammer, and the other guy shoots him, and it's a case of excessive self-defense, or what was his state of mind? When you're going out to get the hammer, was he, coming back? Was that premeditated, deliberated? Boggity, boggity. It's shades of guilt. Shades of guilt mostly is what occurs. So, if guilty means you did the facts, did the facts. But was he insane? Was he coerced? Was he entrapped? Was he, in any way what they used to call, diminished actuality? So you have... My God, 40 defenses that don't amount to he didn't do it. I'm in one now where she didn't do it. She didn't kill this guy. She drove a car, but she didn't know what her occupants were going to do without going much into the facts. She was from out of town. She was not a Sereno. She does not speak Spanish. She is not Hispanic, and it's a terrible thing to be kind of reverse racist, but I have to point it out because she's not part of the gang. And therefore, she drove for a few hours because her brother was involved to some degree, and then she left. And from my perspective, I have pretty goddamn close to innocent client. She had no guns. She has no record whatsoever. She goes to college. She moved away 2 years before. She was only back there that day, unfortunately, because she had an appointment with the doctor, young woman with cancer. So have I ever represented someone guilty? On a few occasions, this is what occurs. You got no defense. You can't beat the case. But you got a hell of a good appeal. It was a motion to suppress. It should have been granted. Or a coerced confession that should have been suppressed. So what you'll do is you'll go through a mock trial, because the DA, if he gives you a deal, he takes away your appeal. Do you know that, ladies and gentlemen? They tell you all your life, if you listen. You get 2 days in court, one at the trial and one at the appeal. No. You're looking at 10, I'll give you 5. I'll take your appeal. Nobody could win on the appeal. He'll get bail from the appellate court. We could beat the whole case. You want to go for 5, baby, or you want to risk it? So you're confronted with that. But I've done a number of trials where I'm merely preserving appellate error. Merely preserving appellate error. So that's the kind. There's another kind that you go to trial on where the person guilty and the rationale isn't to preserve appellate error. We call it a long probation report. So you want to bring out mitigating factors. Mostly federal and state courts, in terms of sentencing hearings, you get a very abbreviated period of time. You got more than 3 witnesses, Mr. Serra? This is only a sentencing hearing. Oh, no, Your Honor, we got 6 witnesses. They don't want to give you time. It's all time. Expedite. They are going to cut our heads off on the expedition issue. So a long probation report is that you get
the person up there, not the defendant won't testify, but you put on a whole bunch of character witnesses. Or you show that the victim was, you know, worse kind of a human being than the defendant was. The victim would have been killed by someone else anyway. Or so what you're trying to do is mitigate when the court has discretion. Sometimes no discretion, you're screwed anyway. But where there's discretion, where you believe that traditional type of sentence here is inadequate, then you could put on a trial. I've done it. I haven't done it recently, maybe not in the last 20 years, but merely to show the guy's a pretty good guy, and what you're really ultimately doing toward the jury is pure nullification. I had a case recently where, you know, two gang members are fighting. One gang member kills this guy's son as retaliation, so next time my guy sees him, shoots him in the back. Well, it turned out he didn't have a weapon. He got shot in the back. Well, that's first-degree murder. I did it because he killed my kid. Well, it's the heat of passion, but, you know, they call it reason returns after a protracted period. So it had happened 2 or 3 years before, so it's hard to say it was in the heat of passion, although we tried. So that's the kind of case that goes down. And what we did for the whole trial is show how homicidal the victim was. What a bad guy. But the jury wouldn't give him anything because it was an outlandish killing, you know, open, notorious, et cetera, et cetera. All right. I think we've done the formal part. All right. Thanks.
Our thanks to J. Tony Serra, extraordinary defense attorney based here in San Francisco, for his comments today on his life periods, yellow, green, purple. And we also want to thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.